9.5 minutes past 7 o'clock in the morning. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. And as we do every Monday at 7 o'clock in the morning, we have our state capitol report this hour. We're going to spend the hour talking about what's going on, or perhaps what's not going on in state government, depending on your point of view. And as always, we welcome our Capitol correspondent for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Sean Johnson, who's going to help us try to sort through all of the stuff that's going on in the conference committee as the Republicans and Democrats try to come up with a budget that everybody can agree on. Sean, good morning, and thanks for coming in this morning.
Sure. Good morning, John.
You know, as I'm reading all the stuff that's coming out, and well, let's back up a second. In June, when I was substituting for Joy that month, I had on the co-chairs of the Committee on Joint Finance, and their version, the version of the budget that passed the Joint Finance Committee, was fairly close to what the governor had originally proposed. There were some changes. And so for just a moment, it almost looked like sanity had broken out, and then reality reasserted itself. And I knew that we were in trouble when I saw the Democrats' version of the budget that came out of the Senate. You just knew that the Assembly was going to come back with something equally weighted toward their political point of view, since they're controlled by the Republican Party. It doesn't seem to me, I don't ever remember the two houses coming out with budgets that were this far apart. I'm trying to figure out how in the world the conference committee is going to ever be able to get a version of the budget that will be acceptable in both houses. What do you think?
I think the rest of us are trying to figure out that same question. And you mentioned June when Joint Finance wrapped up its work. It just seems like such a long time ago now. The Senate and the Assembly passed their own versions of the budget that are $10 billion apart. One has government-managed health care system that replaces the current health care system. One gets rid of all new tax increases, looks a lot different than the Senate's version. And so far, the conference committee has met three times, and if you figure that they're there to resolve differences, they haven't done anything by that measure because they haven't compromised on anything to this point.
It sounds to me like all they've really been able to do is to agree on the shape of the conference table and how many people would be in the room. I'm being facetious, of course, but truthfully, they haven't done anything.
I think they would probably tell you there were 580 items in the budget that both the Senate and the Assembly agreed to. And these are things like funding for senior care, funding for DNA analysts at the state's crime lab. There was also an increase in the vehicle registration fee included in that massive package. So on those items, lawmakers brought those to the conference table last week and said, hey, let's agree to what we've already agreed to. But there's been no movement aside from that to this point.
For those who may have been off planet for a while and are just showing up and wondering what all this is about, take us through the major differences between the two budgets.
I think a lot of the big differences have to do with how much they spend. We mentioned that the Senate and Assembly are about $10 billion apart. The Assembly spends around $56 billion in its budget, and the Senate around $66 billion. Even if you compare it to the governor's budget, and the one that passed Joint Finance spends around $58 billion compared to the $56 billion out of the Assembly. So just in dollar figures, that's a pretty significant difference. And a reason it's different is because there are fewer tax increases in the budget that passed the Assembly. And with that, you have fewer programs funded.
The stories that have kind of popped up and become leads in the news: the Assembly Republican budget proposed getting rid of the University of Wisconsin Law School because one Republican lawmaker said there were too many lawyers in the state already. Is Speaker Hipsch being kind of held captive by the more conservative members of his party because he doesn't have a big enough majority?
Well, you know, the point about the majority is true. He can only afford to lose a couple votes in his caucus because the line is so slim in the assembly. So what that means basically is that everybody in his assembly Republican caucus has a voice. And if there's one lawmaker who wants to get rid of funding for UW Law School, Speaker Mike Hipsch needs that lawmaker's budget or that lawmaker's vote to pass a budget. And so you saw a lot of things in there that the rest of us are kind of wondering, how strongly do they feel about that? You know, is that really what they want? The UW Law School has been one of the more publicly discussed items of that. At this point, I heard, you know, one Capitol observer say that the speaker has to put on a show, and, you know, he has to go to conference table every day and defend this budget tooth and nail, and that's what he's done so far. He hasn't shown any sign that there's any of this that he doesn't believe in.
We're at weather time. Let me give the phone numbers and to give people a chance to join us. People are already starting to call, so if you want to get in, dial quickly. 800-642-1234. Toll free anywhere you can hear this broadcast. 263-1890 if you're in Madison. You can also send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the state budget this morning on the State Capitol Report with Sean Johnson, and we'll be back in just a moment to continue that discussion. I'm John Bunson, sitting in for Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 17 and a half minutes after 7 o'clock. Coming up later this afternoon on Talk of the Nation from 1 until 3, you get the day's issues and discussion on the topics that really matter to you, and you can call in and lend your voice. Talk of the Nation coming up after 1 o'clock this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the state budget. That's the main item in the state capitol report. The conference committee between the Assembly and the Senate is meeting to try to hammer out differences between bills passed in both of those houses and get something on the governor's desk, hopefully before the next fiscal year starts. Right now, things aren't looking the best. We're talking about this with Sean Johnson, State Capitol Reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. And we have a couple of lines open if you'd like to join our discussion. 800-642-1234, toll-free, 800-642-1234. In Madison, please use our local number, 263-1890. Let's take a phone call real quickly here because we've got Ann waiting for Madison. Ann, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to see the amount of money each member of the Assembly and the State Senate has gotten from various groups. And it looks as if the Republican version of the budget was written directly by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and the Bradley Foundation. They want to destroy public education at all levels. They want to get rid of public broadcasting in Wisconsin. They want to make sure we don't have an adequate medical treatment system. Just everything the Bradley Foundation and WMC believe in is embodied in this outrageous, really, it's just a dare. It's not a serious document, and it takes away the veil of pretense that the Republican Party in Wisconsin is anything but a servant of the richest men in the state.
I guess I'd say that a lot of that information is pretty available. It's a nice thing about the state's ethics board website, for example. You can look and see which of these groups are pressuring lawmakers around budget time. And WMC every year, budget years, will be one of the top groups pushing lawmakers and the governor. WEAC, the state's teachers union on the other side, will be lobbying hard their Democratic lawmakers. So, there's definitely influence at the Capitol when there's something contentious coming up in the budget in the joint finance hearing room. It's packed with lobbyists.
Well, Sean, take us through the week that was in terms of state government and what happened, and maybe it doesn't all have to do with the budget. Of course, that's the 800-pound gorilla in terms of news right now, but there are some other things going on in state government. Take us through the highlights of the past week.
Well, just on the budget first, the thing that was discussed the most, I think, this week was the Senate Democrats' universal health care plan, and this would use a $15 billion payroll tax and basically replace the health insurance system in Wisconsin with a system where everybody gets the same type of coverage in Wisconsin, and it's paid for through employers and employees. And Democrats brought their main author of that plan to the table, and here's what Middleton Senate Democrat John Erpenbach had to say.
By pooling together, by all of us chipping in, paying our own fair share, costs come down. Coverage is great, and I think that we've solved the health care problem here in the state of Wisconsin.
And Republicans came to the table and said, hey, we have our own plan. You may not like it. It's not as far-reaching as yours, but their plan is, I think it's accurately described as a market-based approach. It's not as aggressive as Democrats, but what it would do, the centerpiece of their plan is a tax deduction for health savings account contributions. And their basic argument is that if healthcare consumers are more involved in the money that they spend on healthcare, they'll make better decisions and the costs will come down. Here was Assembly Speaker Mike Hipsch.
That is what this country was built on. That free market is what made this country strong. Why would we abandon it in the issue that is the most important to the people of the state by all of our acknowledgement, and that is health care? Don't abandon that idea.
And then you're going to see this week one of the first real tangible effects of having a budget drawn up late in Wisconsin. Of course, the start of the fiscal year is July 1st. Budgets are never drawn up that quickly in Wisconsin because the way it works, the old budget just kind of takes over for the new one. So this week, UW Board of Regents is going to have to set tuition, and they're going to set it at 5.5% for the coming year. That's more than they had said they wanted to. That's a level that's recommended by the UW system. And here's spokesman David Giroux.
We have students arriving on campuses in a matter of weeks, and they need to know how much college is going to cost this fall. Their parents need to know that. They need to know that. They deserve answers. We've never quite faced this situation where we have not only no state budget, but perhaps the widest rift in the state budget in state history, something in the order of $10 billion differences between the two versions. And within that, about $140 million gap on funding coming to the UW.
Then there was something non-budget related last week that's worth noting. Governor Jim Doyle has been there's been an investigation going into whether campaign contributions from utility executives to his campaign influenced the governor's appointments to the Public Service Commission and specifically the PSC's decision to reverse itself and allow the sale of a nuclear plant to an out-of-state company. And last week, the Republican Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, said that he found no evidence of any wrongdoing, and the governor told reporters afterward that he wasn't surprised.
Well, I know nobody did anything wrong. I understood that in a political year, there was all these kinds of accusations and innuendos that were made, and that's why it was fine for anybody to look at what happened. I know who the leadership of the Public Service Commission. I know how they make their decisions, and I don't think there was any legitimate claim that they'd ever done anything wrong, and I think this verifies that.
So a pretty busy week for the middle of the summer. Sometimes it can be kind of sleepy at the Capitol.
Well, and of course, this is not an election year, so we don't have any campaigns or anything firing up. But it certainly looks, when you look at the budget that both parties are looking at next year when there is an election, if you look at the two budgets, the impression that I get was that they were written to provide message points for the next campaign.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've ever seen a situation where, you know, both parties are saying, hey, vote for me. You know, I'm a real Democrat here. I'm a real Republican. They're definitely trying to outdo one another, it seems like. And it's hard to imagine something coming up in the next year and I get the year and a half or so before the election, that's bigger than what they're proposing now, especially, you know, on the Democratic side, it's hard to imagine them doing something that eclipses a universal health care plan. It's a pretty bold plan, even if it doesn't have much chance of passage in the legislature this year.
Let's take a phone call, and we'll go to Roger in Iowa County. Roger, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. As a chapter of the Wisconsin, another chapter of the Wisconsin school shooting is closed last week, I was wondering, are there any legislators bringing forth any proposals to help combat bullying and teasing in schools, whether that be crisis line reporting, stricter legislation to prosecute bullying, anything?
That's something that's been brought up in the past, Roger, and I'm not sure what the status of it is this session. In the past, that hasn't really gone anywhere in the Republican-controlled Assembly, I believe. I can't tell you for sure where that legislation is this year. I do know that at the Capitol this year, it's been you haven't seen much of anything. I guess become law, just because both sides, know that they're going to have a hard time getting something through the other chamber, and so the budget's kind of dominated discussions this year, and there hasn't been a lot of activity in the full Assembly and Senate.
Does the fact that the Democrats have both the Senate and the governor's chair give them the upper hand here?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, that's something that's come up at the conference table among legislative leaders over and over again. Republicans have said, how are we going to deal in good faith when anything we come up with, your guy has the final look at? And Democratic Governor Jim Doyle has extensive partial veto authority, and he can take out big chunks of the budget and leave other pieces intact, and sometimes basically change the meaning of the budget.
Has the governor taken a position on the Democratic Senate plan about universal health care?
He's never come out and said that he supports it. From day one, his approach has been, look, I live in the real world, we've heard him say several times, and he wants the legislature to approve his Badger Care Plus plan, which back when he introduced it in February seemed pretty aggressive and pretty sweeping. It would expand the state's Badger Care programs to ensure that more low-income people are covered and all children are covered. Back then that seemed to Republicans like a pretty liberal proposal. At this point, that may be the middle ground because it's nowhere near as sweeping. It doesn't change the system to the degree that the Democrats do. So that's where he's at. He's never come out and endorsed the Democrats' universal health care plan.
We're just about at news time. Let me give the phone numbers again because we do have a few lines open if you'd care to join our conversation. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Madison, please call us at 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. It's the State Government Report. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:35. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week. This being the 7 o'clock hour on a Monday, it's the State Capitol Report. I want to, before we go any further, thank Sean Johnson, our State Capitol reporter, for spending the first half hour with us and trying to give us an overview of what's been going on in the State Capitol. Always enjoy hearing Sean's reports and finding out what's going on under the dome. The budget dominating the discussion in this first half hour, and it will in this half hour as well, I'm sure. Let me give you the phone numbers to call in, but first let me tell you who our guest is going to be for this half hour so that can kind of guide the topic of your phone calls. My guest is Michael Berkley, who is the legislative director of Wisconsin Property Taxpayers Incorporated. So perhaps if you have a property tax-related question, this would be the half hour to call it in. Let me give you the phone numbers, and we do have some open lines. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Madison, please call us at 263-1890. 263-1890. And we also welcome your emails. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Michael Berkley joins us by telephone this morning. Good morning. Thanks for getting up at this hour and talking with our listeners.
Good morning, John. I'm always glad to talk with you.
From the perspective of your organization, what's good and bad about the two competing budget proposals, and what would you eventually like to see come out of this conference committee?
Well, actually, both of the budget proposals would achieve some form of property tax reduction, or at least hold property taxes within the rate of inflation adjusted for growth, which is something we've always asked them to do. And both achieve this objective in about the same way. The Senate version proposes allowing local governments to increase their levy by 4%, a little adjusted for additional growth and other matters. And the Assembly sets that limit at 0%, or the growth due to new construction, whichever is greater. And then each of those proposals contains provision for increasing the state's share of local government expenditures, and each of those proposals also recommends increasing the school levy credit, or the above-the-line tax credit, by $100 million a year. The Assembly proposes going $200 million in the second year, and the Senate proposes $100 million per year. So both of them would achieve some form of restraint. Unfortunately, the Senate proposal is likely to increase the average tax bill by 3.54%. The Assembly proposal freezes the increase in taxes at less than 1%, which is exactly what the last budget achieved. And we're looking for reenactment of the old freeze, the one that they passed last time, to limit spending to 2%, or the rate of inflation due to new construction. And that would actually freeze individual homeowners of existing homes, freeze their taxes at less than 1%. That's what we hope they would do, with a real freeze on existing properties.
Isn't the assumption behind property tax freezes that local units of government have complete control over all expenditures?
Well, yes and no. Remember that county governments primarily also have to live up to state mandates for providing general services like mental health, alcohol, drug abuse, courts, services that generally have nothing to do with property or maintenance of property. And so county governments are actually mandated to provide a whole variety of services, and they can decide how to spend most of the money that they get from the state, and they have to live within spending restraints, and they have had to for the past 4 years. There's been some form of spending restraint, and municipalities generally have also been under what was called expenditure restraint program, which limited the amount of increase that they could add to their spending And it was sort of a carrot and a stick sort of thing. And if they held their increase to the rate of inflation plus 60% of the increased value due to new construction, they would receive additional state aid to offset the cost of local government services. So there are already restraints on local governments, and the restraints have worked quite well, in both in terms of allowing the taxpayers to authorize increased spending above that limit by referendum, and that has resulted in some genuine tax relief.
Let's go to the phones and take a call from Karen in Darlington. Karen, good morning. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I'm concerned about the tax burden that the property taxes are putting on senior citizens. Wisconsin has some of the highest property taxes that I know of, and it's really quite difficult when you go on a fixed income to actually stay in your home. We have fantastic benefits for people, but you can't, if you can't stay in your home, what's the point?
Yes, well, there are a number of programs, of course, to offset the property taxpayers' burden, especially for seniors. There's a number of things, the so-called reverse mortgage proposal, which allows one to pay off their property tax by borrowing against the value of their home at a very, very low rate, and that is a state-sponsored program. There's the Homestead Tax Credit, which for lower-income people, including retirees, provides substantial tax property tax relief, pays virtually all the property tax, and it's a refundable credit. So that is something that everybody is entitled to. And the problem, though, is that if property taxes go up more than one's income goes up, one has to make some bad choices, or you have to choose between one medications and food. And as the cost of living increases, your cost of living goes up. And you can't afford to pay more property taxes than your income increases. And that same problem needs to be addressed, we think, in this budget, as it was last budget. And that is to freeze the taxes on existing properties.
May I just have one say? I think that Italian seniors are suggesting to seniors that they do a reverse mortgage on their property just to be able to afford their property taxes is somewhat obscene.
Well, it's one way of being able to cope with hyperinflationary tax increases. We propose, however, to end hyperinflationary tax increases as the real solution.
Let's we'll go to a weather break, and then we come back. There are some other callers waiting, and we still have some open lines, so let me give the phone numbers really quick. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That is a toll-free number. If you're in Madison, please call us at 263-1890, 263-1890, and our email address, if you'd like to make a comment that way or ask a question, is talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Michael Berkley. He's Legislative Director of the Wisconsin Property Taxpayers Incorporated. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7:47. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. This week on the Ideas Network. After 11 today, Larry Mueller's guest offers advice on your personal computing problems. He's Peter Green of InfoStar in Madison. That's after 11 o'clock this morning here on the Ideas Network. This is the State Capitol Report for a Monday. We had Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Reporter Sean Johnson on in the first half hour, talking in general terms about what the legislature has been up to, and of course, the budget is the big news in Wisconsin's legislative report this week, as the conference committee is meeting to try to iron out differences between Republican, the assembly version of the budget written by Republicans, and the Democratic version that came out of the Senate, neither one of which bears a whole lot of resemblance in a number of respects to the budget that the Joint Finance Committee passed and sent on to the Senate and Assembly in June. And this half hour, we're talking with Michael Berkley, who is Legislative Director of Wisconsin Property Taxpayers Incorporated. And obviously from the name, you get an idea of what their primary concern is. And Mr. Berkley, just before the weather break there, Karen, I think, was expressing the frustration of a lot of homeowners in Wisconsin about property taxpayers, and certainly that resonated with you. And her particular issue was senior citizens and what they can do when they're on a fixed income. But it seems to me that doesn't all of this really point to the fact that property taxes are a really dumb way to try to finance government programs?
Absolutely. You know, back when the state was first formed, that was about the only way to collect money and for government services. It was related to you used as much service relative to your the value of your property, and that included practically everything they could count and hold in their hand. But times have changed. The state is, in the past century and a half, has certainly changed. The economy has changed. We've got the income tax, which was, by the way, proposed to eliminate the property tax.
Yeah, and how's that working for us so far?
Well, it didn't. Property taxes continued to go up, and then we had the sales tax, which was initiated, and they said that was going to reduce property tax as well. Actually, really didn't. As you know, property taxes have, at least for the past decade, except for the past 2 years, have gone up at almost double, triple the rate of inflation every year, and that's what puts a squeeze on taxpayers. It's that hyperinflationary tax growth. Very few people get raises that exceed the rate of inflation by 1%, and yet government has been spending two or three times that, increasing that every year, and that's what's caused the problem. You know, we think that every property owner should pay for the services that benefit their property, you know, protection of the people that live in it, as well as fire, police protection. But no property owner should have to pay for general government services, which apply to everybody, such as health and social services. Unfortunately, at the present time, property taxpayers are, in fact, subsidizing other people's services to property. There are many, many, many exemptions from property taxes. There's some in the budget, in fact. What we think needs to be done is we need to limit the spending increases at local government level and increase state aid to offset the cost of these general government services, which property owners shouldn't be paying for in the first place. And by the way, not just property owners. Renters also pay property taxes. Landlords don't pay property taxes. They collect them from their tenants. So when you talk about property taxes, it affects everybody. And it affects renters as well as farmers and homeowners and businesses. And we think they all deserve a break.
Let's take another phone call. This time we'll go to Gary in Greendale. Gary, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have a question for Michael. I too am a retired citizen who owns my own property, so I do have a concern just like Karen does. But here's my question. I would really like to get some specific ideas and answers regarding my assessment. Whenever I have a property assessment, the assessment goes up, and of course my property taxes will be increased. We have an opportunity to attend a meeting where we can defend ourselves regarding the increase in the assessment. I have had no improvements in my home, but it's always listed as under the improvement category. I've been on the home or the property. And because of that, my taxes will go up. So what my question is what can I do? And I've never done this before, but what can I do to attend the village or the meeting, at the village hall, and justify the fact that I don't deserve a property tax increase because there hasn't been anything that's been done to my property?
Well, let me start out with, when you look at your property tax bill and it says the value of the improvements increased, that doesn't refer to any improvement to your property. That line represents the buildings and on it, and so you have land and so-called improvements, and the improvements are essentially the buildings. And the assessment is supposed to be, by law, reflective of the fair market value of your property. Now, if you believe that your property is not valued at its fair market value, but above its fair market value, you are entitled to go to the Board of Review in your community. When you get your assessment notice every year, it will say when that Board of Estimates will come in and look at your property, but you have to go and attend it. You can attend an open book session to take a look at how your property is valued relative to similar properties in the same area. So, and then you can go before the board and see if it doesn't reflect the real fair market value. And usually that's based on recent sales of similar properties in your area. So the assessment generally has to be, and so it's fair to everybody, has to be based on your fair market value. And you go to the Board of Review. The Board of Review may or may not approve an adjustment. Sometimes you can talk to the assessor if it seems out of line, and they may make an adjustment. And sometimes they make mathematical errors that they can cure as well. If the Board of Review does not approve a change, then you can go to the Department of Revenue and appeal, or you can go to the Circuit Court and appeal the assessment. But generally, if your house is assessed at 90% of what you would be willing to sell it for, that's probably about fair.
Well, that's very helpful. My other question is, do they take into consideration people who are on fixed incomes?
No, everybody has to be taxed the same based on the value of their property, their portion of the jurisdiction's value. But there are mechanisms for reducing that burden. One is an income tax credit, two are income tax credits, which offset what you shouldn't have paid in the first place. Those mechanisms, including there's a school levy credit that is on your tax bill that comes off the bottom line. So there are mechanisms for reducing that burden, but not related to your age or your income. It's related to the value of your property and the amount of property taxes that you paid.
So get back to a discussion specific to the state budget as we wrap up the program here in the last, say, minute and a half. The Democratic proposal that came out of the Senate included something that should be good news for property taxpayers, and that is universal health care coverage. It seems to me that if you look at state and local units of government and school districts, their fastest growing expense is employee health coverage. What is your group thinking about the Democratic health proposal?
Well, we certainly like the idea of being able to reduce the health care costs. We're not quite sure that this is the way to do it. However, you know, the Senate version proposes something that they say will save property taxpayers about $1.8 billion annually. That's not small change. But we think there might be alternative ways of achieving that objective. And the other thing is that there's nothing in the Senate version that would allow local governments or government agencies to really take advantage of that, of those savings in the bargaining agreements. So it's difficult to. There is no mechanism to save that 1.8.
Okay.
You know.
Thanks so much for joining us this half hour.
Well, thank you, John.
Michael Brickley is the legislative director of Wisconsin Property Taxpayers Incorporated. Leo Duran produced this program. On-air production from Karen Prager and Cheryl Gasser. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine.